Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, the Faith Edition, where your healing and faith journey matters. Where faith and trauma-informed healing unite in safety, empathy, and compassion. For more information on coaching opportunities and other resources, visit thehealingtraumapodcast.com. Now here is your host, Monique Coven.
Welcome, Kurt. I am so honored. I've been waiting for this. I've been waiting for this day. I am just so honored. What can I say? I can start by saying I love your work. I love your podcast. I love your authenticity in the podcast. I love the jokes you guys have between. I'm always laughing hysterically with you guys. Because it helps us to see that you guys are so like, you're like us, you know, which is just so lovely. And well,
Well, let me just say, Monique, it's it's been a real joy to have our conversation just before we recorded, and I'm it's humbling, and I'm honored to be here on your podcast. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real joy to be here.
Thank you. It is such a joy, such a joy. You know, it's when I first was in contact with you, I'm like, okay, we're going to talk about shame. And then I read, so let me, I read The Deepest Place, which is Suffering and the Formation of Hope. And I'm currently in a book club with some ladies from my community, and we are swallowing it up slowly. We just are getting so much out of it. And then The Soul of Shame was read, which we love.
All these fun topics.
Oh yeah, they're just so lovely. No, but they are so important. That's why I can't get enough. The autonomy of the soul and the soul of desire. So I was like, okay, we'll just talk about it all. I'm like, no, we cannot do that. But I think what I'd like to do, because there is this theme in all of them, is I'm going to pull out what really I think, as a survivor of trauma and as someone who, you know, I have people listening who've suffered from trauma, and especially childhood trauma, and we know how it impacts us today. These themes of hope, which is something we so desperately want in our life after trauma, talking about shame and how it impacts us, suffering, and how do we develop hope after suffering? Many of us are still suffering. And of course, you talk about perseverance, and the way you talk about that is exactly how we start to change our brains and our bodies and start to reshape our nervous system. So, I don't know, where would you like to start?
Well, I mean, I am more than happy to go wherever you would like to go with this conversation. I think, as we also were commenting before we started to record, when we look around at the world, it would appear that the world is not in a great place. And at the same time, I would say I think it would be fair to say that the world has never been in a great place. I think if you were in first century Corinth and you were a slave under the Roman rulers, life would not have been a great place either. You could have been even a Roman citizen. And if you're the mother of a baby who wasn't a boy, and we just decided that we're gonna like throw her in the ditch because that's what people did, life would not be in a great place. The world has never been in a great place, no matter what we would like to believe about any golden ages at all. And now more than ever, we look around and there are just lots of places that are really hard. And we, as we were saying, like, we need rescued. We need help. We need help from the outside. You'd think that with all of our technology and all of our ingenuity that we would have somehow solved all our problems, and we only seem to be digging our holes around us more deeply. And so I love So the fact that you have a podcast that is that people are listening to means that somebody who needs help is now hearing your voice, and they have the opportunity to be open to rescue. Somebody is coming for them. Mm-hmm. And so one of the first things that we would say about all these topics, whether it's trauma and the shame that is kind of like one of the primary driving forces of it, or the suffering that we endure and our longing for hope, we know that if those things are going to happen, we're not going to generate healing on our own. We live, 500 years of modernity and the Enlightenment would tell us that, we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, and I can figure things out on my own, and I will self-declare what I want in my life. So so we're trained to think that we really are these siloed people, even though we're not being told that explicitly. And the problem with that, of course, is that that's just not how my brain works. My brain, as you've heard me say, my brain is always looking for someone looking for me. Right. I don't need that person to overwhelm me or to swallow me. I'm not looking for that. But in order for me to survive, let alone to flourish, I need to know that someone is coming for me from the time I enter the world to the time I leave the world. I need to know that someone is coming for me. And so when it comes to trauma, we talk about how, one of the features of trauma that we taught, one of the two big pillars is this sense that something happens that in which I'm overwhelmed. And then the other pillar is that I'm not only overwhelmed, but I have no sense of agency to do anything about the overwhelm. And the common thread of both of those pillars is that I am alone with my experience. One of the common features of the neurophysiological phenomenon of shame, because as we like to say, shame, before it is a cognitive thing, before it is an abstract idea, it is a thing I feel in my face and my chest and all the things. Mm-hmm. It's an embodied experience, yeah. Because first we sense and only then we make sense of what we sense. Shame's primary function is dependent upon me also being isolated. So there's a theme here. Trauma, shame, when we talk about suffering. Suffering, we would say, is our response to pain over time. That pain is something that I experience as some kind of noxious sensory experience, whether that's physical, whether that's relational and emotional, whatever that is. It's some kind of uncomfortable, unpleasant experience, but the degree to which I experience that and my response to that over time then becomes my suffering. But suffering itself is also deeply dependent upon the feature that, again, that has been, we've named it already, suffering is fundamentally a feature of being in isolation.
Yes.
And so, and then interestingly enough, behind all of this, for our listeners, we would say that, one thing that we humans do that's different than any other animal, at least as far as we know, is that we are storytellers. It doesn't mean that we're the only animals that remember things. Deer have to remember where the corn is or where the best trees are that they're going to return to every year. The elk are going to return, or the squirrels, where are my nuts? I remember where I put those. But we don't have any evidence that those same squirrels are having conversations among themselves in which they're talking about how this year's harvest of acorns was so much better than last year's harvest of acorns. Right. We don't have that evidence. Maybe they are. They're just not telling us. I don't know. But the point is that we humans, from the moment we begin to develop language, use language to tell a story about our experience. And we are doing this all the time, all day, every day. First we sense, and then we make sense of what we sense. And the way that I make sense of it is through the story that I tell. And my telling of my story means that there is a story in which I believe I'm living. And every single, all 8 billion of us, it's true. each one of us, everybody who's listening to this. And now we often don't think about this. We're often not like being curious. Oh, what is the story that I actually believe that I'm living? But I can tell you, that's exactly what you're doing. That's, you know, each of us is doing this. And so there are these big, you know, narratives that we have in the world, like things like, oh, I'm alone in the universe, like and the material world that I can see and sense and measure is all that there is. That's what we might call like a materialist view, a material that I can, it's all there. There are other views, like the view that I would hold, and that is that, like, I believe that I'm a creature. I'm not just a collection of, you know, protein and protoplasm and so forth, but I've been made on purpose by a God who loves me. Now, of course, there's all kinds of evidence in the material world that, you know, might call that into question, right? And especially when we start to talk about trauma and shame and suffering, we can look around our lives and we're just like, well, I don't know, if there's a God out there who loves me, like, I don't have really much evidence that that's the case. But it doesn't stop the fact that I'm still having to tell a story about my life. I kind of believe that. And the story that we read about in the Bible, for instance, the story that God begins in the middle of chaos, right? That the world was formless and void, and chaos in the deep was what was dominant, and God hovered and spoke and brought order and purpose. And despite the fact that we humans have found ways to live life differently than God had intended, and here and hence so much of our carnage and our shame and our trauma and our suffering, the God of the Bible has not given up on us. And this culminates, and we would say, in the coming of his son, Jesus, who is committed to being present with us and wading right into our worst selves. And this is an example of this. This is the rescue that we're saying, that we Christians would say that we need. And it is not a rescue that comes with violence. It is not a rescue that comes with force. It's not a rescue that comes through a set of creeds. It is a rescue that comes through a person. And that's how any of us are only ever rescued. We're rescued by other people. And so for our listeners, my longing is for us to be curious about who are the people who are coming to find us, in the same way that Jesus has come to find us, the same way that God and Jesus has come to find us. Because it's in those spaces that we create community in which we can become seen, soothed, safe, secure, in order for our traumas to be healed, our shame to be literally, our story of shame to be retold, and that hope in the middle of our suffering becomes something that we form durably. The most durable forms of hope do not come because everything goes well for me. The most durable form of hope that I form, I don't form, we form together. We form hope for me. We form hope for you. We do this together. And we do this in the middle of our painful experiences, such that we can learn that in the face of all of our carnage, you're not leaving the room. I'm not leaving the room.
I want to talk, like, stop, just in case people don't understand that you're talking about a community, a safe community, what you call mm-hmm. confessional mm-hmm. communities.
Yeah.
And I love that idea so much because I've always said, we can't go back to the past, but mm-hmm. I knew that there must be a way that God's going to redeem it. And, yeah. and that would be in the present. I just wasn't mm-hmm. quite sure how. Mm-hmm. And the idea that I've learned about in the book is in the books is mm-hmm. through these communities where we come with our suffering and all mm-hmm. that it entails, mm-hmm. the ugly, the mm-hmm. truth, the pain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What happened, mm-hmm. and we bring it before other mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. other safe, loving people. And mm-hmm. when you said, and they don't leave the room, mm-hmm. so many of us mm-hmm. as trauma survivors have had repetitive experiences of being basically on the floor, just in pieces, and people leaving the room.
Right.
So when you mentioned that, I just, a hope started to light up in me. So this is what you're talking about. Can you say more?
Right. Well, I think, you know, as we say, right from the very beginning, we say that, like, every baby comes into the world looking for someone, looking for her. Mm-hmm. And that never stops, that process of my looking for someone, looking for me. And that process is only made more pressing when I've had some kind of injury. If I'm a toddler and I fall down and skin my knee, I go looking for my mom or my dad even more intensely than I typically would. So when there's a wound, when there's an injury, I'm even more so. I'm looking for that person who's looking for me. And I could be, I could be the 40-year-old whose child has just been given the diagnosis of cancer. And I think that my worry, of course, is about my child, when I would want to say to our 40-year-old listener, my worry would be about you. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we know that the child is the center of the issue, yes. And at the same time, we know that your heart will be breaking like nobody else's will, not even that child's heart. Mm-hmm. And so who's coming to look for you?
Mm. Ooh, that touches me. Ooh, beautiful. Yeah.
Or, and we have a whole host of any different ways in which trauma comes to find us. Mm-hmm. The question is, who's going to come to find us? Who will come looking for us when we're looking for them? Because this is how the brain is made to operate. And when people do come to find us, so in these communities, one of the challenges, of course, is that also like children, your three-year-old comes to you with her skin knee. And of course, this is really painful for her, and she's running and she's really upset. But then when you say, well, let me take a look at it. No, I don't want to look at it. Right. Because it's painful even for the three-year-old. And then for the 30-year-old or for the 60-year-old, we have symptoms. We have troubles, right? I'm anxious. I'm depressed. I'm drinking too much. I find all kinds. I'm looking at pornography. I'm doing all these things mm-hmm. to cope with my distress, my suffering. I'm trying to medicate this in some way, shape, or form. And of course, I would like my symptoms to go away. But when I come into the community isn't there just to get rid of your symptoms. The community is there for healing. And as we say, there are many of us who want to be not sick, but that's different than wanting to be well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. I come in and I want to tell my story. And I am probably not even aware of the parts of my story that I have practiced hiding from. And I'm so practiced at them that I don't even know that they exist anymore.
Wow.
Until I'm listening to somebody else in the community, in the room, talk about how angry they are at their father or at their mother, who kind of still steamrolls them, even though they're a full grown adult and they've got teenage children and so forth, but they still have parents who are behaving badly. And, you know, as I'm listening to them, I find myself starting to feel things. You know, mm-hmm. I was sure I grew up in a lovely home. I grew up in a home where my parents loved me and I loved them and so forth. And why is it that when they're talking about their anger at their parents, why am I suddenly so much more angry than I, like, well, maybe perhaps things were not nearly as nice in my house as I'd like to think that they were. Because, of course, you know, if I grew up in a house, it's a classic story that I tell. This is not uncommon, where I asked him, well, tell me what it was like growing up in your house. And he said, I grew up in a really loving home. I said, oh, tell me about that loving home. And he's telling me, yes, I have parents who love me. And, you know, I did well in school. And he said, tell me this. And this is a person who's very, very anxious, despite the fact that everything in his life is going so well. Mm-hmm. And then I asked the question, well, who is in charge of discipline in your house? And they said, well, I guess that would have been my mom. Yeah, because anytime my dad got involved, especially if it had to do with one of my siblings who, you know, had their own set of troubles, my dad would become physically violent in the house. And then I say, so help me here. You just told me that you grew up in a really loving home. Help me make sense of how it is that that's the story that you tell. And we would say, look, he's not lying to me. He's telling the story he has to tell in order for him to survive the brutality of his house. Mm-hmm. And now there were things that were actually starting to happen in his own life. His own life, his own family with his own marriage and kids, mm-hmm. that were starting to feel really chaotic, not unlike the chaos of his own home. But this is an example of how we can build narratives in which we tell the story of our life in a certain way in order for me to survive my story, in order for me to survive interacting with other people who, you know, I go off to college. Hey, tell me about you. Hey, where are you from? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm from this place. So, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. It would be way too embarrassing for me to talk about what's really happening. So this is why we would say, like, it's not a surprise that when we say that, you know, the fish that we caught that was only 8 inches long, if I keep telling the story long enough, frequently enough, that the fish was actually 24 inches long, at some point, that is exactly the memory that I have. I'm not even aware that I'm not telling the truth, because I'm constructing the truth as a way to cope with the fact that I'm really embarrassed that my fish was only 8 inches long. And it's when we find ourselves in these communities in which people start to have conversations that start to evoke things in us that we can't keep under wraps any longer. And finally, we get the opportunity to allow those parts of us that have been wounded, that we've been hiding, because we're so ashamed of them, mm-hmm. we allow those parts to come into the room, not to scold them, not to shame them, not to you know, shower contempt upon them, not to tell them to not. We're not trying to get rid of them. We want them to be healed. We want those parts that we are even angry with, the parts of me that I hate the most, that I just want to, like, somehow, if I could get me a neurosurgeon that would cut those parts of my brain's memory out, like, that would be great. Mm-hmm. But instead, this is a community that is intending to allow those parts to come into the room for them to be healed as well.
So when you say intend for them to be healed, how are they healed?
Well, you know, an example of this, so we'll just use the same case. This is a person who's in my office and he's in his 40s. And again, if he were to give you a list of what his life is like most days, everything looks like it's turning to gold. Like, it's just one accomplishment after another. And yet there is this part of him that when he starts to talk about it, everything about his body becomes rigid. He becomes tearful. He starts to feel shame. Because he has the only experience that he has with the memory and his awareness of this part of his story is that of fear and violence and shame and isolation that has all pretty much been kept in the privacy of his own mind. His neural networks and the memory that they hold of all this trauma in his house, they are held in isolation by him.
Yeah.
And now he wonders why he's having panic attacks, because his body is done doing this. And so if I begin to ask him the question, tell me about what it was like when you were 12 and when you were 15 and when you were 20 and you're in the kitchen, and your father is choking your sibling. He's never had an experience in which he could name this, even in the privacy of his mind, in which he would feel anything other than fear and shame. Except now, he's literally in the room with someone, me in this case, and that's not the experience that he's having. He's having the experience of someone who hopefully is offering him compassion, who's offering him grace, as we would say, who's offering him mercy, who's offering him a wide place to stand, and who, when he starts to feel utterly out of control I don't leave the room.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine, you know, mm-hmm. several months later, when he's now in a confessional community, when he's in a group of people in which the payload of brain activity in the room is seven times that of what it was when he's just talking to me. And he gets seven times the empathy. He gets seven times the felt sense of protection from others around him. He now literally in his body is having an experience that he's never had before when he is recounting this event.
Amazing.
Right. And so what's happening neurally, what's happening in the brain, is that heretofore he's only had an experience in which his memory of the event only brings about suffering. Right. And the neural activity of fear and shame, your brainstem is the primary thing that's in charge, your brainstem, your limbic circuitry, all your fear mechanisms are going off, the surge of the stress hormones, all those kinds of things are taking place because he doesn't have anybody in that setting in his experience who's looking for him. But now he does, and what this means is that those same neural networks that represent that experience are now being met by a different set of incoming sensations coming from other people that are going to turn other neurons on in his brain that have never been turned on before, that begin to literally calm and bathe and nurture and to quiet his brainstem activity and his stress hormones. He's being cared for in the very middle of the recounting of the story. This is a way for him to first literally have a new neurophysiological and interpersonal experience that is going to register as a different set of neural network firing patterns in the brain. And this gives him the sense that, oh my gosh, I'm not going to go back to the kitchen when I was 15 and somehow rewrite history.
Yeah.
You can't, we're not changing the event. But as far as we say this, we remind people that as far as the brain is concerned, there's no such thing as a thing that we call the past or the future, as far as the brain is concerned. Now, this doesn't mean that there isn't a past and there isn't a future. Mm-hmm. But what this means is that even as you and I are sitting here talking with each other, if we were to think like, oh, what did I have for breakfast this morning? And I can picture, you know, the bacon and eggs and so forth, whatever it is in my kitchen and so forth, I can picture that. And I have the felt sensation of being back there a few hours.
Yeah.
I'm not back there a few hours. I'm right here. But my brain is constructing a felt sense of the past.
Yes.
But it's happening right here and now. And so even though I don't change the facts or the events of what happened when I was 15, I am now going to alter my experience of my memory of that, such that my emotional response to those events is categorically different. But it is so because primarily I am not in those events by myself. I'm actually, it's different because Monique is with me in the room. Or if there's six or seven of you that are with me that are in the room. How many times have we heard in the course of the work that we do in these confessional communities, how many times have we heard unsolicited one of our members say to the group, yesterday I had the hardest conversation I've ever had with an employer or with an employee or with my parent or with my adult child. And I had a conversation that I'd never been able to have because all six of you were in the room. I know exactly where you were standing. I heard your voices. John, I felt your hand on my shoulder.
You're going to make me cry now. It's so precious.
And I'm in the middle of a firefight, and I'm completely at ease because I'm not by myself in the middle of this. And of course, this is what we would say, ultimately, that God has done in Jesus, that he's come for us, and he has entered into our worst nightmares. Mm. I mean, crucifixion, it's generally considered like there's never been designed by human beings. And, you know, it like the Greeks, it was the, you know, those whom we love to talk about being, our cultural ancestor, they're the ones who invented it, and the Romans perfected it. It was a torture mechanism, not just for the individual, but for the culture around it, to humiliate people, to subject them. And the Romans had lots of ways of killing people, but they could have beheaded Jesus. They could have given him an archer's firing squad. It would all have been done, but that's not what they did. And so it's this sense of God coming to be present with us, mm-hmm. and then not, I mean, like, I'm not leaving the room. Mm-hmm. Not leaving the room. Mm-hmm. And this is what my longing for our listeners is that they, who are going to be the people who are going to be present for you and who are not going to leave the room?
Yes. 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 And this is where the hope is, because this is what we didn't have, and this is what we can have. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking, there's a word that I learned in my somatic work, which is a disconfirming experience that changes us. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. These are mm-hmm. disconfirming experiences of all those experiences we've had in the past where people left the room, that people didn't care, that didn't make eye contact. And it starts to give us hope and change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And change. Right. Yeah. And speaking of hope, I mean, this is what we talk about hope. I mean, this is why the brain science for me is so exciting. When we think about the word hope, in this most recent book, I talk about the formation of hope. We live in a world in which it's like, well, gosh, I hope that I can be hopeful. Well, somehow, like, I just kind of think it's just going to like land in my lap. And as it turns out, hope is a thing that we are actually employing all the time. Most of the time, we don't know it. I stand up to walk across the floor, and I hope that the floor holds. Now, I'm not thinking to myself, "Oh gosh, I hope the floor." I'm not. But that's. I'm anticipating that the floor is going to hold. Another way of saying that is that I hope that it will. I hope my car will start. Mm-hmm. All the things, just dozens of things, all day, every day. We don't really start to talk about hope until we're talking about things that we are imagining that we really desperately long for, but for which there is the outside chance that it's not going to happen. Hmm. And that's when we start to recognize that when we talk about hope, we are talking about a future state. If I'm hoping for something, it's something that's going to come, whether it's 5 minutes from now or 5 years from now or whatever. I hope in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's when it's really helpful for us to recognize how the brain operates in terms of time. Because my future that I think about is always something that I generate out of my past experience.
Yeah.
I actually remember my future.
Yep.
And therefore, hope being a future state is something that I actually can form by having lived experiences right now, wherein which in the middle of my painful experience, whatever that is, if I am surrounded by a community of people who are not leaving the room, who are coming to find me, it does not eliminate my pain, but it lets me know that I am not alone with it. Yep. People are sharing my distress. I'm aware that I'm being seen, soothed, safe, and secure, even in the middle of ongoing pain, whether that's cancer or the fact that my son's not coming home from Iraq or that I've lost somebody for a drug overdose, all those painful things, people are going to be with me.
Yeah.
And so I have an experience in the present moment of being comforted even in the middle of my worst time. And if I have multiple experiences like that, I begin to log them into my memory.
Yeah.
My hope becomes what I form by having these kinds of experiences that lead to an anticipated future in which I know not that everything will be perfect, but that I know that I will not be left alone when all the things that are hard may come.
I'm like speechless because I'm like, Who gave you this information? Because this is exactly what we need. It's what we need. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also want to say this. This requires effort. This requires great effort. The news, as I tell people, the news about shame in particular, the news about shame is far worse than we know. And it is far better than we can imagine. Because if we're willing to put these things into practice, we're going to discover a couple of things that will emerge. Number one, the first thing we will discover is that the work of forming hope takes time. And it takes effort. I tell people, look, life is very simple. It's very simple. And it is excruciatingly difficult. But it is not difficult because it's complicated. It is difficult because of the ocean of fear that sits on top of our ocean of shame that we carry with us. But in between us and those oceans of fear and shame, we construct a lattice work of narrative, just like my friend who said, I grew up in a loving home. I construct all kinds of sophisticated stories that actually protect me, from my fear and my shame that I carry. And so when it comes to trying to figure things out, I say, well, it's really, really complicated. And what's happened is I've made it complicated because of the intricacy of the narratives that I tell as a way to protect me from those parts of me that I can't tolerate being with in the room. Mm-hmm. And so the work that we do requires lots of untangling of all of that lattice work, which is what makes it feel complex and complicated and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so it takes real effort to do this. Mm-hmm. And so that takes work. But we live in a world in which we are actively trained, being trained to believe that we shouldn't ever suffer.
True.
That we should be able to have what we want, how we want it, when we want it. I tell people, look, now my Amazon packages arrive before I order them. They're just, I don't know how they're doing this. But that's what they're doing. And consequently, I'm trained not to have to delay gratification. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't have to delay gratification. So we will hear our podcast here and say, oh, well, this is such great news. And think like, oh my gosh, my suffering should be done in like 10 days. And that's not the way it is. So it takes work. And here's then the other thing that happens. The more willing we are to reveal more parts of ourselves, we think, oh, this is great. It's like when someone says to me, Kurt, how long am I going to have to be in therapy? How long is this going to take? And I say, it will take as long as it takes until you get to the point where you discover that you love doing the work. At which point they say, wait a minute. Doesn't that mean if I love doing the work that there's a good chance I won't want to ever leave? And I'm like, well, that'll be up to you. I don't know why you would leave something you love. But the point being that as we reveal more of who we are, we discover that there's real freedom in this. We discover that we have far more agency to become the women and men that we were intended to be. At the same time, we would also like to imagine that the more I do this work, at some point, like there won't be any more work left to do. And it actually turns out that it's just the opposite. The more work I do, the more work I discover that there is to do. And this becomes, I talk about in the book how we suffer for three main reasons. We suffer because of things that have happened to us. We suffer primarily because of what we do to ourselves unwittingly. We're not aware that we're doing this, the stories that we tell ourselves, all that. But the third way that we suffer is when we decide that we are going to move toward wholeness. we are going to move toward integration, when we are going to move to the light, when we are going to throw off our addictions, there is a certain suffering that is going to take place, because we're going to be at this and we're going to discover that 6 months from now and 5 years from now and 20 years from now, I'm still working on some of these things, and it will be maddening. Like, why do I still have to deal with parents who in their 80s are still behaving badly? Why can't I just have figured this out 20 years ago? That suffering takes place, in fact, because I am becoming a different person. In the same way that if you've never run at all and your first little run that you're going to do is like, 2 miles, and you get back and you like, all you want to do is throw up. You're like, that's awful. And then, but then you you get out and you run 3 miles and you're pretty good at it. But then you stretch it to like 4 miles. Oh, okay. But then you stretch it to 7 miles. Like, then you decide, I think I'd like to run a marathon. And you see the suffering continues because we are becoming more than we imagined that we could be. And we live in a world that we would say, it's not a neutral universe. You know, we Christians, I would say, I live in a world in which there are forces in the world whose intention it is to devour us. Mm-hmm. Goodness and beauty is anathema to evil. And so we're pushing against forces that would actively resist the growth that we are longing to live into. And if we are not aware of that, we will be ignorant of it to our peril. And so there is this suffering that continues. At the same time, because we know its nature and because we are doing this together, we are able, as I say, the brain can do a lot of really hard things for a long time, as long as it doesn't have to do it by itself.
Yeah.
And as we do this, we are able to develop the kind of hope that is more durable than just that which says, I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you nailed it in one of the books that I read. Basically, I think the fear that we have, especially when we've had trauma, but probably even, I mean, everybody's had trauma, but is this fear of being absolutely alone, bottom mm-hmm. line, you know, mm-hmm. and your work is just that talk of, or that show that, but I'm not alone in it. The suffering may be, but I'm not alone in it. And mm-hmm. I remember I had this profound experience that made no sense to me at all. Many years ago, I attended it's called Healing Prayer. Mm. And they were doing some kind of a prayer. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, what came out of my mouth, I'm like, who is that? Was this little voice that said, I'm alone, I'm alone, I'm alone, and terrified. Mm. And I'm like, where did that come from? Like, I would have never said anything like that. Mm. But and it just, when I think about it, it's, that really pretty much sums up, I think, our greatest fear is to be completely alone mm-hmm. in this world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I would say one of the things that your podcast is doing for our listeners is they're having the experience of not being alone, even now as they hear your voice. And, our traumas, they take up a lot of neurally, they take up a lot of real estate mm-hmm. in the brain. And so, neuroplasticity is a beautiful thing in that we can form new neural networks. We can tell new stories. We can develop new ways of sensing and imaging and feeling, and then making sense of old traumas. At the same time, it is important to know that that takes practice. Our traumas take up a disproportionate amount of our neural networks. And so we need to practice this over and over and over mm-hmm. again. When we'll be in these confessional community experiences, and someone will have some kind of an experience in a moment of transformation in which they you know, they've told a part of their story they'd never told anyone, and something changes for them in that moment. And it's tempting for us to be really joyful and delighted that they've just had this moment and we're there for a period of seconds, and then we're ready to move on to the next thing. But that's not what we want them to do. And so we will pause the process and we will say, we want you to now talk about what just happened to you. We want you to talk about what it's been like in your body. We want you to talk about who are the particular people in the room and what did they actually say? And what did you see? So we want them to do basically a full court press review of what has happened in all of its details. Not unlike a movie director is going to go back and they're going to look at all the details of the film, including the sound production, all the things, all this kind of detail. And then once we have that experience for them, then we say, we want you to go home and we want you to write the screenplay for this. We want you in your journal to retell this story as if I were going to read in your journal and I could see the video from what you're writing. And I want you then to replay this video every day for the next 6 weeks.
Oh, I love it.
I want you to take 5 minutes and I want you to replay this. Because in so doing, you're doing the same thing that you do when you're learning your multiplication tables. Mm-hmm. You are committing this to a particular form of memory that is unlike multiplication tables. It's not just abstract facts.
Mm-hmm.
You're replaying a felt sense of something in your body, a felt sense of the story that you're believing, that these other people are believing about you, all those kinds of things that are intended to be part of this enterprise of forming durable hope.
I love that. And, you know, just the whole idea, because our bodies are so used to, you know, they're looking for what's going to go wrong. And so I used to say, it's almost like we're turning our face like sort of another way and doing these practices. The very first time I learned about practices that made a difference, even before I was learning all the trauma training, was through, and I know you know her, Anne Voskamp's book. And I started practicing every day, looking for those little joys that, not just looking at them and it's a cognitive thing, but taking them in. You know, when I see something beautiful, like right now I'm looking at this beautiful, like yellow-leaved tree that's blowing. How does that feel in my body? And so I would be doing that all day, and it was, and stopping and feeling it. And I was starting to notice that I was feeling happier, more joyful. And that's just an example, I think, of what you're talking about.
That's exactly
right. The practice of, changing.
It's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So this brings me just so much hope. And you know, you talk about confessional communities. Can this be done and people don't, let's say they don't have a confessional community? What would you suggest?
Well, specifically, there are a couple of ways that we're trying to provide some opportunities for people. We have a nonprofit, the Center for Being Known, that is, you could vk.org, and we are developing opportunities for people to enter into these confessional communities online. You can check out that website and you can find where there are cohorts that are being developed for that. We also do in-person intensive trainings for these things in our practice in Northern Virginia. That's New Story Behavioral Health. I have a podcast called The Being Known Podcast, and my co-host and I, Pepper Sweeney, our most recent season, it was about a 6 or 8 episode series on confessional communities that you could listen in there, and you get some ideas about how to go about, starting to give this a go.
Yeah, I love, really, really, again, recommend your podcast. Just love it. So thank you so much for this. I wish I could talk to you for a couple more hours or.
Well, maybe another time. That would be fun. That'd be fun to do.
Oh, you are such a delight. I just thank you for your life and your work and what you're doing for us. It's so appreciated.
Well, that's very kind. I tell people I don't deserve my life, and I can't believe I get paid to do what I do. So I mean, gratitude is really the only it's the response that I have. I'm just really grateful to have been able to spend time with you, and it's been a real delight. So thank you for inviting me to be part of your podcast.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
Bye.